Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast looking at the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XXII, What an Artist Dies in Nero. So previously in the podcast, we've heard about Nero, his rise to power as emperor, his youth and inexperience in the role, his 5 good years probably put down to 5 years of good influence. He starts churning through a number of wives, he has his mother Agrippina killed, and a fire tears through Rome, but on the upside it leaves him the space to build an absolutely smashing palace. Nero's in a position where he pretty much gets to do what he likes, and believe me when I say that he makes the most of it. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
After the 5 good years, everything seems to have slid fairly quickly. Not only is Nero not interested in what emperors should be interested in, or Roman aristocrats in general, military and political affairs, he doesn't train to be an orator, he doesn't carry out any of the normal activities of the highborn Roman male. He's much more interested in kind of lowborn activities, like he's really interested in music, which is fine, but he's actually interested in performing, in singing and acting as well. And that would be okay as well, but he's interested in doing it on the public stage. And I think we've mentioned before that actors and singers and gladiators are the lowest of the low in terms of social scale. They're seen as kind of equivalent of untouchables. They're on the same trajectory as prostitutes. They put their bodies out there for people's pleasure. They actually lose legal rights in Rome. So this is exactly what an emperor shouldn't be doing, and it's what Nero desperately wants to do. He first performs on stage in Naples, which is a Greek city, so he clearly thinks he can sort of get away with it there. Nero is very interesting, especially if you read Suetonius, but Tacitus as well. You can almost see a kind of an attempt at psychology, at doing an analysis of Nero. Obviously, that's very anachronistic because Tacitus and Suetonius have never heard of that. But they talk about how he just can't stop himself. And also, Suetonius mentions that he wants to play particular parts on stage, and it's parts like Oedipus or Orestes, who are Greek mythological figures. Oedipus famously kills his father and marries his mother, which sort of equates with Nero's incest with his own mother.
Alleged.
Alleged incest. And
sorry, I don't know why I'm defending him.
Orestes killed his own mother, Clytemnestra in Greek mythology. And of course, Nero is probably responsible for his own mother's death.
So the insinuation here is that he's come out of his childhood a bit scarred.
Yeah, exactly. Suetonius basically says he has terrible dreams, really bad nightmares after the death of his mother, and that he feels terrible guilt for it. So it's like he wants to sort of expiate it by performing these roles on stage. But it's not just these roles. He generally wants to perform in public. And this is one of the reasons that scholars often see the Neronian period, and Nero in particular, as what they call a very performative period and performative emperor. It's like everything is performed. All right, so when we finally get to it, his death scene is performed. This whole idea that everything is a sort of a mask, nobody's really showing their true selves. So there's always acting going on. And Tacitus has this very telling statement that Nero, when he's married to his first wife, Octavia, who's the daughter of Claudius, that Octavia learnt very quickly which emotions not to show. She learnt to play a part. So she's acting. She's got to act within this relationship because she basically realizes that Nero's unhinged and that this is a very dangerous household. Unfortunately, it doesn't save her, and Nero has her exiled and then has her accused of adultery and killed off. And Suetonius says, you know, this is all rubbish. She's actually a very chaste wife.
Was the power going to Nero's head?
Well, I think you'd be quite justified in thinking that power corrupts in this case. That after the 5 good years, the so-called good years, when, you know, Seneca and Burrus are no longer around, his mother's gone, he just has all the power in the world, at least in the Roman world, and he's going to exert it. He's not going to do what people want him to do. He's got loads of money. He can use all of this money. He doesn't have to spend it wisely, so he doesn't. If he decides that he doesn't want to be married to Octavia anymore, then she's gone. And he does very strange things with this ritual of marriage. He's supposed to have married two freedmen of his, so men, one of whom he married as if he were the bride. So Nero dressed up as the bride and married this freedman who was called Spearbearer, Doryphorus, which, yes, there is a double entendre intended there. And the other one was a eunuch called Sporus, which means seed. And Nero married him as the husband. It's supposed to have gone through the ceremonies with the two of them. Obviously, they couldn't be legal Roman ceremonies because of these men's status and because of their gender. So he's not going to abide by any of these categories. A lot of what Nero does is breaking through categories. He doesn't care about the social status of being an elite Roman. He's going to act as if he's a low-born one that wants to sing on stage. He doesn't care about the kind of category of being a Roman man in terms of these marriages. And it's almost like there are no boundaries. He doesn't have to observe any of the boundaries. He also acts as a criminal, part of this excess. It always reminds me of, you know, the sort of out-of-control children of rock stars or famous people who have loads of money and kind of the only way to get a buzz is by taking drugs or going into shops and stealing things that they don't need to steal because they could buy them. This Nero does this. He goes out at night with a gang of thugs and beats people up. And the worst part of this, according to our sources, is that other gangs of thugs, thieves and so on, start getting immunity because people recognize the emperor. And obviously they're not going to challenge the emperor. So other people can pretend that they're the emperor doing this. And that means they can get away with it. So it's almost like he's also a bad role model. He's acting not only as a low-born criminal, but somebody who's attacking his own people. He should be protecting them, protecting their interests. But according to Suetonius, it was as if Rome was under siege. So rather than taking warfare or taking aggression to other places, creating new provinces or whatever, he's internalizing it. He's taking the violence into the city.
So the Senate must have hated this, but if he's spending so lavishly on excesses, for the most part, the people of Rome must have loved him.
Well, some of this excess is being spent on them. And actually, this is one of the things that scholars discuss and debate, particularly with regard to Nero's house, that villa, the Golden House. Was this something that was just built for him, his own private villa? Or the fact that it has all of these lavish gardens, was it something he was actually going to throw open to the public? There's a big difference. There's a tension there that's always there. In the imperial period, are you going to be the kind of emperor who does things for the people, as Augustus was seen as being, or are you the kind of emperor that's just going to keep everything to yourself, spend on yourself? Now, Nero's intentions may have been to rebuild Rome for the people. Certainly there are signs of that. But his reputation is that he was lavish only for himself, that this was all extravagance that was being spent on him.
A total playboy then.
Absolutely. And it's the result of entirely negative sources. So it's very difficult to get at the truth because Nero, like Caligula, it didn't end well for him. And that means that everything that's written about him was written by the victors. One of the most extravagant parts of the Golden House was a really, really egotistical feature, actually, which was a huge, colossal, literally colossal statue of the emperor, which appeared in the threshold of the villa. So you enter the villa, you see an enormous, colossal statue of the emperor, and it's golden, like the Golden House, with the emperor's features on it, and it just dominates everything in front of you. So it's enormous. It's as big as the Statue of Liberty. And this statue was one of those things that was very controversial, obviously, after Nero's death. And it was moved. And it's actually the reason the Colosseum is called the Colosseum, not because the Colosseum itself is colossal, but because the Colossus of Nero was right beside it. Later on, under the Emperor Hadrian in the second century, the features were changed from those of Nero to those of the sun god Helios. So that's a way of keeping the statue, but kind of wiping out Nero.
62 elephants.
To drag it along.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Just think of the size of it. I just wish that that was still there. That would have been amazing to see. So being as unpopular as he is, I imagine that the Senate isn't exactly hanging out to keep him around as emperor.
No, Nero's very unpopular with the Senate and with Roman elites at this point, which isn't to say that he's unpopular with everybody. The ordinary people may still have loved him. And indeed, he's popular in the provinces, especially in Greece. One of the reasons he's unpopular at home is that he's seen as a Hellenophile. He loves Greek culture, but he kind of loves it too much. They're not really comfortable with that. So he becomes increasingly unpopular until in 65 CE there's a conspiracy to get rid of him, which we call the Pisonian conspiracy because a man called Piso seems to have been behind it. And it doesn't work. Okay, Nero's going to live another 3 years. It gets revealed, like a lot of conspiracies. And really, the point about the Pisonian conspiracy is that, well, there are two points. It proves that he's so unpopular that they're prepared to try and assassinate him. And secondly, it leads to a whole lot of deaths. And really, it gives Nero the chance to wipe out a lot of the Roman aristocracy. And also to wipe out a kind of literary renaissance that he's been behind. He's a great patron of the arts. He's interested in the arts. And he's sort of had this entourage, starting with Seneca, who was his tutor, of people who are writers and musicians, particularly writers, around him. And they all get implicated in the conspiracy. So Seneca's nephew, who's a man called Lucan, was a really fantastic poet. We've still got his epic. It's actually an epic of the civil war between Pompey and Julius Caesar, called The Civil War, or sometimes called Pharsalia. And Lucan's very young. He's in his 20s, but he's known as kind of the poetic genius of his time. He's implicated in this conspiracy and told that he has to go kill himself. And the rumours are that actually Nero was jealous because Nero wasn't as good a poet and he knew it. There's also an implication that Lucan had fallen out with Nero, which is perhaps borne out by Lucan's introduction to his epic poem, where he talks about how Nero is obviously going to be deified when he dies. And this is going to be a bit of a problem for the heavens. They'll have to decide where he's going to go. And he's going to have to sit in the middle, because if he sits either side of the heavens, it will overbalance. Which you could read as really farcical praise, you know, that he's so great that he's going to overbalance the heavens. Or you could read, as many people do, as a kind of underhand sly way of saying that Nero was overweight and having a little dig at him. And that probably didn't go down well, if that's the way Nero read it. The other person to go is a man called Petronius, who is the author of a really weird early novel, fantastic novel called The Satyricon, who was Nero's kind of right-hand man in terms of the arts. People sort of see him as the minister of culture.
But he's a better writer than Nero?
Probably. We don't have any of Nero's writings. But Petronius was part of the inner court, part of the inner circle, a man who basically decided what was cool and what was not. And his death scene is actually the very last thing that is in Tacitus's annals, because unfortunately Tacitus's annals breaks off again at that point. Mm. It probably had another 2 years to go, but it breaks off in 66 with the fallout from the Pisonian conspiracy, which picks up, as I've mentioned, Lucan, Petronius, and Seneca himself. And it's sort of the culmination of a whole lot of deaths that Nero has caused.
So when does a conspiracy become outright rebellion then? Because this can't have made him any friends. I'm sure it didn't shore up his position at all.
Well, it's interesting that it's not so much conspiracy that happens after that. And this is an important change in Roman society, I think, because at this point, it's commanders within the Roman army that start to rebel or conspire or whatever you want to call it. They plot to overthrow Nero. And there's one sort of conspiracy rebellion in Gaul, from a man called Vindex, which is very appropriate because it's the word that means avenger in Latin. So that's actually really? His name. What a great name.
Nice.
And that doesn't work. But in 68, we start getting commanders all over the empire who decide that they've had enough, or at least that Nero's unpopular enough that if they move, then they can take over. And that's actually their goal. So we have three in particular. We have Otho, Galba, and Vespasian, and they're in Spain and Gaul and in the east in Judea, and they all start to move on Rome. They're acclaimed as emperor by their troops at some point. This will end up in civil war, and it'll end up with Nero really in despair, ending his own life.
So he's never been really known as a military commander. So what's his reaction when he sees armies coming towards Rome?
Well, remember, we don't have Tacitus at this point, but Suetonius makes him sound like a really rather pathetic figure. He's absolutely terrified. He starts acting in a really irrational way. He thinks about, at one point, trying to sort of cut a deal whereby he'll go and be governor of Egypt and they can have the rest of the empire.
Wow.
He tries to hide away. He tries to run away. He says things to his freedmen like, you know, I need to kill myself, but you have to show me how to do it. You should be the example to do it first. I can't do it until you've done it. This whole kind of panic that seems to overtake him at that point. But even amongst the panic, we still see that propensity for melodrama. Some people think these are his last words, but as Suetonius writes it, they're not quite his last words. When he decides that he is going to die, he starts saying over and over, "What an artist dies in me." So the world is going to lose such a great figure, you know, and that's what he wants to be remembered for. I think this sort of sums up that idea that we've mentioned, that it's not so much to being emperor that interests him. He wants to be a famous figure as an artist. And he can't be because he's caught up in this wheel of having to be emperor. But he's not carrying out his duties as he should be. Apparently, he tries to kill himself in various ways. He's amassed all of this poison, but that seems to disappear at some point.
He tried to drown himself, didn't he?
Yeah, and he fails at that too.
Yeah.
And in the end, he tries to stab himself, but fails and has to get one of his freedmen to help him. So it's a sort of assisted suicide, I guess we'd call it, a suicide murder. Almost.
Right. So he's the last of the Julio-Claudians, though.
He is.
So I imagine once he's dead, he's not deified. And he's probably not really missed either.
Well, he is missed by some people.
Yeah.
Even though Suetonius is so consistently negative about Nero after the five good years, he says that some of the ordinary people do miss him. He isn't put into the tomb of Augustus. He doesn't get into the mausoleum of the Augustan family. But he is put into the tomb of his father's family, so the Ahenobarbi. And he's had a kind of strange relationship with that side of the family, actually, because, of course, he's adopted into the Julio-Claudians, into Claudius's family. But periodically, and apparently towards the end of his life, he starts to see himself as a Henobarbus again, like he's reverted to
right. That
identity.
Were they perhaps Greek?
No, very definitely not. But early on in his life, when he'd just been adopted, one of the reasons he would get annoyed with Britannicus, we're told, is that Britannicus called him Ahenobarbus when he should have been calling him Nero, because he's been adopted into the family of Tiberius Claudius Nero. So he's got this weird identity crisis going on that's sort of summed up with his name. And that's the tomb he ends up in, quite appropriately. And there are ordinary people who come and mourn and carry out rituals for him. And there's also this weird aftermath whereby people think they've seen Nero as if he's not dead. It's like a sort of Elvis thing. They think he's still alive out there somewhere and he might come back, which sort of sounds like a wish fulfillment idea. And I think it's 20 years after his death, Suetonius says that there's a man claiming to be Nero and actually getting things out of doing this. You know, people will put him up for the night and treat him well. So there is definitely some fondness for Nero that has been largely covered up by our negative elite sources. The ordinary people may well have loved him, and the Greeks certainly loved him.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and please share it with your friends and leave a review there. We've got a fast-growing community on Facebook, so come like the Emperors of Rome page and join in a conversation about this podcast. You can also follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. This podcast brings an end to the Julio-Claudians, and in the next few episodes, we'll be looking at the topics that you requested. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.